Welcome to another episode of The Top Shelf, and today we have Mitchell Hashimoto, former CEO, CTO, and IC of HashiCorp, and today we talk about why Zig is awesome, why Go sucks, and the new Ghosty Terminal. And a quick shout out to our sponsor, Graphite, a great tool for working asynchronously. All right, let's get to the episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Top Shelf. Today, we've got Mitchell Hashimoto here. I'm your host, Tej DV, and with me, I've got a ghosty contributor, the Primogen here. Mitchell, we're excited to have you here today. We're both ghosty users, and we think it's really impressive how you moonwalked through your career, starting as a successful CEO, then a successful CTO, then a successful IC, and now, most impressively, a successful unpaid OSS maintainer. So thanks for joining us today here to talk about ghosty. Mitchell, welcome.
Thanks. Depending how you contextualize what you just said, it's either a massive success or a massive failure.
That's one of our questions. Yeah. Did you fail upwards or did you successfully, I forget what the other one's,
succeed downwards.
Succeed downwards or fail upwards?
You know when you like go up to the top of a hill and you just like throw your body off of it and you're sometimes like in control and sometimes just flailing wildly? It sort of feels like that. But for the most part, I think like I ended up without breaking many bones, you know, like it was like mostly a success.
Nice. I did actually want to sort of ask about that progression in a serious way, not just as a, you know, meme stinger, about sort of how you feel about that and sort of any, I don't know, like learnings or anything interesting along the way, because that is sort of like in a lot of ways kind of the opposite direction a lot of people go.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. So I'll just try to like keep it tight.
You don't have to keep it tight. This is you.
Keep it as
long as you want.
It just, you know, if you get in the details, it ends up getting boring. I mean, I think the big picture is interesting enough, which is that I think that, you know, one thing I got out of going through all those different roles was a lot of empathy that every single role is a really big job, whether you're an individual contributor or a CEO or a CTO or a VP. Like, I went through all those paths and they're all individually different responsibilities and, you know, difficult. And through going through those phases, I just realized what I really enjoyed more than others. So it's a non-binary sort of thing, right? Like, I didn't hate being a CTO. I actually quite enjoyed my time as a CTO. The problem was that I really wanted to hack on things more than being a CTO. Like, it was a relativity thing. My time is zero sum. And then I wanted to figure out where I wanted to spend my time. And I tried to find the right moments where I was able to sort of back down and do these separate things. And that's sort of what ended up happening with me. But I guess like my conclusion whenever I talk about this with people is, you know, figure out what you really love to do and figure out what the right sort of trade-offs are for your life and your family and things like that, and just pursue it.
Can you explain a little bit more about the right trade-offs for the family? What do you mean by that?
I think that, for example, like I think my time being like in senior management, you're very, very visible. You're on the road a lot. You're like sort of, you get pulled into, you know, the saying that we would always say is like the shit flows up, you know? So, as if everything is working great, then at senior management, you hear nothing. Like, you do like end up doing very little if everything's doing great, but every problem that ends up below goes to their manager. And if they can't solve it, it goes up. And by the time it reaches you, all you're dealing with all the time is just like the bad stuff constantly. You know, that puts a lot of stress and makes you travel a lot and makes people angry at you. And, you know, if things like that aren't, I guess, healthy for, it can be unhealthy, I should say, for your family life, then you could reassess. And then there's also the financial component as well. Like, obviously, in corporate America, at least, like, the more senior manager you are, the more you tend to get paid. And if that's, you know, if the trade-offs are worth it for you, like that stress and then the pay is worth it, like then go for it. But you just, it's like, it's, there's no strictly correct answer, I guess.
Do you ever feel like being an IC, you can also spend equally as much or more time? If things are going good, does that mean you spend more time as an IC? Is it like an inverse proportional relationship there?
That's sort of how it was when I was like CTO and stuff like that, was that when things were really good, I got a lot of time to work on I don't know, experimental projects and just like, more things that I actually wanted to work on. But there's still other responsibilities you have, of course. You don't do nothing if everything's going well. But it was really, I would say, the bad times that really caused me to reassess what I wanted to do and conclude that, you know, that my career, I did not want to be an executive.
Nice. I think it's pretty interesting for people just like to hear at least of reassessing where they're at instead of just, oh, I always go to the next step, right? I had a similar experience at one of my first sort of like corporate jobs where I wasn't that far out of school and they were like, hey, do you want to start doing management? And I just said no. And it was so funny because my boss, just he was such like by the book guy, like great dude, but like everything had to be exactly what the handbook said, you know, and all this stuff. And he just was shocked that I might say, no, I don't want to do the standard next step. I'm looking forward to writing software for at least a few more years, you know, and it just was just blank stare.
Yeah. I mean, I think even my family, like throughout these things, like my immediate family always knew what was going on. But like, I would say like my parents and my aunts and uncles, you know, like slightly outside the immediate family, whenever they would like see the news about different career moves I'm making, they're like, isn't this like a bad thing that's happening? You know, it's like generally on the surface confusion about what's going on.
Yeah, hard enough to explain what your company does as like a software infrastructure company anyways. And then you're like, oh, also like I'm not the CEO anymore.
Yeah. I always had to tell none of my family knows what I did then. And they also are extremely confused about what I'm doing right now. And so I just always have to tell them, I promise it's not illegal. And they say, okay, cool.
That's a pretty good way to discuss it. Don't worry, it's not illegal. Everything's okay.
It's good.
Just another day at the startup. Man, I hate Rust. Let's rewrite this and go. And increment the value. And let's test this. It didn't print. It didn't increment my value.
Actually, six lines above where you are right now, you're modifying the copy of the value, not the actual thing itself.
Thanks, DJ. Read.
Actually, you're not going to want to forget deferring closing that file.
Thanks, TJ.
Actually, you better not forget to initialize that map, otherwise you'll have an ill panic.
Thanks, TJ. Not everybody can have a Tej on the remote team, but the next best thing is working together on the Graphite platform. Features like stacked PRs let you work asynchronously, not being blocked on reviews. Graphite has its own excellent code review UI and an inbox that actually works. And now with Graphite Reviewer, you can get immediate, actionable feedback on every pull request with Graphite's codebase-aware AI to speed up your code reviews. That means less time waiting, more time shipping. Please check out our sponsor, Graphite. The links are down in the description or in the pinned comment. And now back to the podcast. All right, so looking to the future, Ghosty has some pretty ambitious plans in two areas. We have libghosty and the terminal application functionality. How do you kind of balance those two things? Because it seems like everyone I talk to is very excited about libghosty. That, like, where can we put it in? I've seen people tweet about, like, VS Code. VS Code better just adopt libghosty because they haven't updated their terminal in, you know, a decade or whatever it is. And everyone just feels like it's very exciting. But then you also just have ghosty, which is probably the average person's concern if they're going to be using alternative terminals, if you will. That's actually really where the most users will be engaged with. How do you kind of balance those things? What are the plans? How do you even prioritize one over the other if you can?
It's mostly, I mean, sometimes they overlap because sometimes improving the ghosty application happens at the libghosty layer and that does both, but there's also a significant amount of non-overlap, and my goal with the ghosty applications, you know, that the Mac app and the Linux app and the future Windows app, is really to sort of draw the line in the sand at some point of like, for example, the Mac app is the best one to talk about because there's a really obvious example here, which is that I don't think that ghosty, I'm quite confident that ghosty will never have as many features in the app level as like iTerm. So if your primary concern when using a terminal is you need all of the features, then iTerm is probably always going to be the best option for you. Ghosty is always like, I talk about the three things I go for, right? Like fast, feature rich, and platform native stuff. And it's always going to be sort of like a balance of those three. And if that's important, then Ghosty is going to be the right choice. So I think at a certain point, the Ghosty app sort of, in my mind, sort of stabilizes to where this is what it's going to be. And my answer after that to people is, you know, go to this other Ghosty, LibGhosty based app, fork Ghosty, build your own LibGhosty based app. Like, you know, like the whole long-term really idea I have with Ghosty is that LibGhosty is the main thing. And that hopefully like gives birth to this like ecosystem of better terminal applications, because they no longer have to worry about the emulator part of the terminal. They could just focus on high level app features. And just based on my experience, the amount of time it took and continues to take to build a good core terminal emulator part, I didn't want to eliminate that for people. It's sort of like, it is a waste of time to keep doing it over and over again, even for me.
So theoretically, I would be able to rewrite tmux in some sort of sense with LibGhosty as it improves. Yeah. And as it gets there, is that then that whole barrier and all that, you're like, no, you actually go build it. We don't want to do it ourselves, but we'll give you all the Legos, if you will, to be able to build it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of crazy to me to think that tmux, iTerm, Ghosty, Terminal App, like Guesterm, Kitty, Alacrity, we all have completely re-implemented identical functionality at the core. And I don't think that's the interesting part about terminals, right? Like that's like the necessary crap you have to build to then do the interesting stuff, which is everything on top. And so like, let's stop doing that. I will say that the Linux community does a little bit better about this, because they do have libvte, which is, I don't know who owns it. It might be a GNOME thing. But libvte is kind of like LibGhosty for GNOME. And it's used by something like 40 something terminals on GNOME. But I think that's like a great example of what's possible. The difference between VTE and Ghosty is going to be cross-platform, more features, more performance, not tied to GNOME, you know, things like that.
What, like, so you said, you know, iTerm's always going to have more features than Ghosty. Like, what are some features you're sort of delineating between the two, or at least for now, you know, not as a forever commitment kind of thing, but.
Yeah, it's very fluid, because there has also been features from iTerm where people are like, oh, I want this from iTerm. And I think, oh, definitely not. And then like 100 people show up within a week and say, oh, I also want this. And then it changes my calculus of being like, okay, just because I don't use this, maybe this is actually more important than I expected. And so we'll bring it in. I think an example that iTerm has that we probably won't ever have is like password management. You know, they have a whole like SSH key and password manager sort of built into iTerm. I don't use it. I know a lot of people do use it. When I think about that sort of layer, you know, my goal is to build a plugin system into Ghosty that could enable those sorts of features. But I'm sure there'll be certain things that also fall outside of that. That's just going to require another front end. But I mean, I think that's one of them. The iTerm has an incredible amount of customizability. I mean, period. But also in terms of tab colors and tab labels and tab icons, and then like you could just lay over text on top of your terminal, which I thought is the most horrifying feature, but a lot of people use that to like when they're SSH into a production machine, it's just big red text in the top right corner on top of your terminal that just says production. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, you know, stuff like that. I don't know if Ghosty will ever do it. It's stuff people use, but I just don't know.
So I kind of have a follow-up for that one, which is that whenever I do something or I make a video and all that, I often never base it on what the loud people are. And the reason being is that often the loud people are not representative of the average person. So how do you know that if 100 people show up and say, oh, we all want this feature, like is just 100 people wanting something the line for you to create it, or is there something more to it? Like how do you know you're actually hitting the right kind of – I don't know, zeitgeist for the average terminal user?
Yeah, this is the hardest part I think in general about creating products, like whether it's corporate or open source or whatever it is, because in the corporate world, this is one thing that frustrated me, whether it was my previous company or any other company that I ever worked at, but I'm not immune to this, is that you end up at a certain scale getting like product managers, right? And product managers, there are excellent product managers, but like in my mind, 90% of them just do what you just said. X N number of customers request this feature, and N is high enough, and so we must build it. It is like scientifically the correct thing to build. And that drove me crazy because there is, it's a signal. It's a signal that you have to listen to, but there's also an element of sort of, yeah, what is the right shape and long-term vision of the product you're building, and how does that feature fit into that, and will it make things harder? Is it a waste of time? Things like that. So I guess, you know, there's an art to saying no, and I think that we have to figure that out. So yeah, when 100 people have a feature that they want, to me it's a strong signal, but it is something where I have to think about it and potentially say no.
Do you ever take what those people say and realize they're asking for something else? And like, is there a moment in which a bunch of people said, we want X, but you're like, no, what you really are saying is you want Y. Let me tell you why. Does that ever happen? And does that actually work out? Or do people get upset because you didn't give them just X? Because this is the product manager problem. This is like the product manager problem here.
That happens, I think, 90% of the time. I think people in general are really bad at defining their own solutions. And so that's part of the reason why I've adopted this sort of new style for me with the Ghosty project, which is all feature requests go through discussions. You can't create issues. There's multiple reasons for that, but one of the reasons is what you just said, is like you create a GitHub discussion, we talk about it, and we use that to actually figure out what you're actually sort of asking for.
And one of the other like axes, I don't know, I guess you said, for like determining Ghosty things and what your vision is for Ghosty is that it's like a native application. Can you describe more what you mean by native in the context of a terminal?
Yeah, I hear a lot of this on Twitter, and it seems like it feels confusing based on the responses I've seen.
Yeah. There's not like a great word for it. Native is like the right word, but native is also the right word for a bunch of other things. So it's kind of messy. I think there's a couple like definitions for native. I mean, one of them is like the idea that it's written in a non runtime based, you know, programming language or whatever. That's the easy one, right? There's a lot of, if that's your definition for native, there's a lot of terminals that do that, like Alacrity and Kitty and Westerm are all native by that definition. What I actually mean when I say native is sort of like a native environment, right? Like in the sense that like, if you put a penguin in your office, then the penguin is not in its native environment, right? It's suffering and it looks wrong and it feels wrong. Like if you put, when I put sort of Kitty, I was previously a Kitty user, it's an excellent terminal, love it. But when I put Kitty on both Linux, where I use a GNOME desktop, and Mac OS, it just sort of felt like a penguin in my office. Like it worked awesome, but it sort of just wasn't like, it didn't feel right. There were certain little idiomatic things for the operating system that were missing. And so when I say native with Ghosty, I mean it in the sense that it, on one hand, it is truly a native macOS application or Linux application. The Linux people could bike shed that, but on macOS, it's Swift, it's AppKit, it's Swift UI, it's using those technologies for the UI, but it's also just integrating things like Sparkle for the update framework. That's not something that's built into the OS, but it's something 90% of native Mac applications use. So when you use Ghosty and it asks you for an update, the way it looks like, you're totally comfortable. It feels like every other Mac app you've ever used. Like it feels normal. Just those sorts of platform specific idiomatic things are what I'm talking about when I say native.
Yeah, the coolest one that I saw, I think it was from maybe the release notes or somewhere else, was the like on Mac when you're typing in a password, like automatic. Mm-hmm. I don't, what's the technology thing that it uses? Some like focus stealer thing?
I think Apple calls it the Secure Entry API. Mm. So to be clear, Ghosty is not the only app, only terminal that supports this. iTerm supports this. I think Kitty does as well, actually, in this case. It's a good example of something that, for example, doesn't exist on Linux. Linux doesn't have this. And so it's something that Ghosty provides that you would expect for a Mac application. Yeah. And
could you explain what that is? Just because I'm not even sure what we're talking about at this point.
Yeah, for people who don't know, macOS has a OS level API where you could enable secure entry mode. And from that point forward, no applications can steal your input. So if another, you know, there's applications that for totally good reasons want global input access, accessibility programs, launchers, things like that. And when you enter secure input mode, it disables all of those because it stops sending your input events to the global taps. And so that means that when there's a password, you could be sure that if another application is malicious or if a benevolent one was compromised, like they still can't read your passwords. And Ghosty just does that automatically.
Yeah, the reason I brought that one up was because it would be nice for Prime to not be able to leak his password on screen key. So that seems like a... like a nice feature for terminals, you know?
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's an exact use case.
I live in the past. I still live on Linux, so I guess I'll just leak it for here on out.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think it's a good example of a Linux of a functionality that, like, you know, the Linux folks in our Discord have gone back and forth of, like, is this even possible in any way on Linux? And due to, like, the layers and separation and not just separation of technology, but separation of ownership of different organizations. Like, it's very hard to build something like this versus, you know, a megacorp like Apple that owns the entire stack could just be like, do it and just cut through multiple layers of technology and just make that happen.
Oh, interesting. So it's the way Linux is developed is hurting this type of progress is what you're trying to say. Or this type of feature.
It's a good example of a feature that's hard just due to the separation between the kernel and the desktop environment and the window managers and so on. Yeah. Huh.
I was hoping we could also take a little bit of a step back and sort of start a little bit about how you got started on Ghosty. And then, you know, after we're sort of on that journey, I'd also be interested to hear where your future plans and vision are for a terminal emulator that you've spent an insane amount of time on thus far.
Yeah. It's in terms of calendar time, it does seem insane because it's probably like 2 to 3 years. But in terms of actual like hours on keyboard, it's far less dramatic because for the first 2 years, I had a job that I was doing other things. And then for the final year, I was very part time on this. So, you know, it looks worse than it is, I would say. But yeah, I mean, I got into it. The reason I got into it 2 to 3 years ago while I had another job was because I just wanted to like do something totally different from what I was doing day to day, partially so that my sort of technical skills don't get rusty, no pun intended, but also sort of also because it's just fun to it gets boring. Like as much as I loved infrastructure, it was getting boring to just like think about Kubernetes every day. Right. Like it's pretty dry. And so I wanted to think about something totally different. So, yeah, I started this project where I was like, I'm going to use Zig. I'm going to do GPU programming. I'm going to go back to desktop software. I'm going to learn about terminals. Like I just picked all these wild things and put them together because I find the most efficient way to learn new things is to actually do something. And so I just grabbed all the things that I wanted to learn, put them in one bucket. A terminal felt like a great way to fit all those in one bucket and started playing around. Never, ever, ever thought I would release it. It was just as like, as it progressed, I realized that I felt like I was building something cool that I wanted to share with other people.
So you actually chose the technologies you wanted to learn first and then thought of a project. You didn't start with going, I want to create a terminal. What does it take?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And like, I feel like I got lucky because even in hindsight, like I think the architecture and the technologies I chose ended up being pretty great for a terminal, in my opinion. But yeah, I didn't, because I never intended to ship this, it was a learning project. I just picked all the stuff I want to learn.
So what is some of the best picks? Do you like of this, what is the best thing you chose to use for your terminal? And why is it Zig?
it is probably Zig. I mean, if you were to point out a single technology, it's Zig, but also I think the architecture is more important than that. That's not technology specific, which could have been any language, but Zig is it was a big bet, but again, 2 years into it, like I'm just having more fun every day writing Zig, and there's like zero regrets about picking Zig. It's just been a great language. I think the thing you could feel and see the most like physical evidence in the over the past 72 hours has been since Ghosty's been released has been how many people have praised how easy it is to compile Ghosty from source. And that's not thanks to me. That's really thanks to the Zig project. And so, like, I think that people are benefiting from that immediately. The other elements of speed and being able to control what I'm doing and things like that, I mean, I think more incidental to people. But yeah.
Yeah, I think my very little experience with the Ghosty code base, which was fixing an off by one error somewhere at some point in the past. Off by one by round. And that alone was like just going from the config into Zig and then navigating around. It felt like a project I could go pretty fast on really quickly. Zig is a very interesting choice. How did you land on Zig and not Rust? Especially 2 years ago, Rust was most certainly, it felt like it was at its peak kind of fervent behavior. So why did you choose Zig over Rust?
I think I'd rather answer the pineapple on pizza question. No, I'm
just kidding. So why pineapple on pizza? Yeah, we'll get there. Don't worry. We'll get them both. How does that sound?
Okay. My answer to this makes everyone mad because...
Oh, you already chose Zig. I'm happy. So don't worry.
Yeah. Yeah. Because technology, like programmers, and especially programmers that care about programming languages, like they want an answer that's like based in some sort of like theory or safety or like something. And my answer, like dead to rights, my answer is just, I have fun writing Zig and I do not have fun reading or writing Rust. And that was my number one motivating factor. Like if I'm going to type and read and debug this stuff every single day, like, I want to have fun. And whenever I've experienced reading or writing Rust, it feels like all I'm doing is implementing traits and jumping between files, trying to figure out what the fuck implements a trait. And I do not have fun doing that. And so, yeah.
Dude, that is such a good answer. Traits have always been the most bizarre thing because you're like, dot read. I know it reads. Okay, what is the thing I need to do to get it so it can read? Like the whole trait inclusion, finding out, like, discovery problem?
You know, you're like on SourceGraph, which I know TJ, I think used to work there. You're on SourceGraph and you right click read and you say jump to definition. It's like, here's 30. And I'm like, no, fuck off. What is this doing? Like, what's actually happening? Like, I don't want to read 30 implementation read. I don't want to go upstream to figure out which trait got created and passed in at this point. Like, it's so frustrating. And so that drives me crazy.
So I know we're supposed to ask you a bunch of other questions that are going to be more like interpersonal about open source and all that, but I do want one more Zig question. Okay, I'm a big fan here. What about the like lack of interfaces in Zig? Has that been any sort of hurdle? Because when I first started Zig, I was just fresh off my I'm going to learn Go for 1 year and really try to understand Go. And so obviously my mentality going into it was completely wrong for Zig. And so I found that to be a very jarring experience.
Yeah, so I came to Zig from writing Go for a decade, basically. And so interfaces were the first thing I looked for, which is ironic given my current trait rant, but I think there's slightly separate problems. But I was looking straight for interfaces, realized they didn't exist, spent like a week watching every Zig talk anyone ever gave on interfaces and dynamic dispatch and vtables and all this crap, trying to figure out how I'm ever going to do this. And thinking that it's a huge glaring hole in the language. And then I think what ends up happening is I never, you know, even though over a decade ago I did write C, like professionally, I got paid to write C at some point in time in my life. Even though that's true, I sort of forgot about that all through the Go years. And it was only after this week and then continuing to work on Zig that I realized, wait, you don't always need an interface. There's an overhead to using interfaces. You know, they're not free. They're not free on the computer. They're not free in caches. They're not free in a variety of reasons. And then I realized that Zig's comp time makes static dispatch via like comp time interfaces possible. And that's actually what I want. And like, I didn't actually most of the time ever want a runtime interface, like a component that I could switch at runtime. I wanted something that just switched at compile time. And so, I just realized Zig's really good for that. And, I don't know. I got over it. I literally never ever miss interfaces. I don't think in the Ghosty project there's a single vtable based dynamic dispatch component in the entire thing. Not because I'm avoiding it, just because I don't need it. And so, yeah, it's a good thing.
Yeah, that's sort of in stark contrast to how you're feeling about Rust, and also how people generally write Rust, I feel like, with traits and everything. Do you think, like, would you write, so you've written a lot of Go, I know that, do you think you'd write Go differently now, like after writing so much Zig? Or do you feel like, oh, Go is designed around this interface idea, so I would keep writing interfaces?
Man, I've never thought about that. I don't think I could write Go again right now.
But I assume Zig would just not be that great. Like, if you had to write a server, I would assume you'd much rather reach for Go than reach for Zig, just because of, like, the highly asynchronous nature, and Zig isn't necessarily fun making a bunch of calls and aligning stuff.
Maybe I'm, like, ill or something, but I think I would just use, like, PHP or something. Like, I don't know. I'm questioning everything about Go's place in the stack because I'm like, on one hand, you have Rust and things like Zig for the actual, like, performance critical, like, core components, and that could expose C APIs and things like that, and you could guarantee safety on the Rust side, things like that. And then you have this move fast and break things web thing where I'm like, do you just want PHP or Rails or something? Like, I don't know. I love Go, the community and things like that, but yeah, I'm in a weird place with it right now.
I love that not only did you just kind of just wreck Go there for a quick second, you also conspicuously left JavaScript out of the list of dynamic languages. Like, there's so many good things with this entire rant that just went on.
Yeah.
That is really interesting. No comment. I share some similar feelings with Go, where in some ways it feels like, I don't know, I don't get the same feelings of joy, like, writing Go as I do other languages, but, like, it's okay for working with other people. I don't know. I'm in a similar, you know, headspace with Go, trying to figure out what my thoughts are on the language.
Yeah, I was always a very vocal, while I was, like, very into Go and writing Go all the time, I was always a vocal I don't know what the right word is. I was always against generics. And people took that in the craziest ways, like that I never didn't understand generics, that whatever. And it wasn't that. It was just like, I guess, like, more generally, I hate this pattern that has emerged with programming languages, where people want every feature that every other programming language has in their programming language they're using. And I think what makes programming languages special is sort of the constraints and designs they impose on you. And so, like, Go to me was great because it forced you to think how to do things without generics. And for the, you know, 1% of the time generics were the right answer, it was annoying. But for the 99% of the time, I think it made me write better software. And so, it's sort of is and isn't, like, a coincidence that I stopped writing Go right when they shipped generics. I felt that it was going to change the culture in a way that, and not just the culture, it's going to change the code I had to read in a way that I wasn't going to have fun anymore. And I don't know if that's true because I haven't professionally written Go since they've made that change. But in the few projects that have been Go that I've been trying to figure something out, I read and I see generics now. Yeah, my eyes kind of glaze over being like, oh, this isn't very fun anymore.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I love so much about Lua, right? Is like, Lua is definitely a language designed by the constraints that it has, right, about, like, easy portability.
Okay, the one-based indexing was unequivocally a mistake.
Unequivocally, absolutely.
The most based indexing, it's one. One is right. Okay, here, hear me out.
Brazilian elevator start at zero.
One is greater than zero, but it's not. It's not.
That's all you need to know. I honestly, in 2024, that's a strong argument. I feel like I could win Twitter wars with that. With that as my case. One is bigger than zero. Which do you want to use, you know?
TJ's been on this for a while. You can just ignore this one facet. Okay, there's plenty of things to like about Lua
plugins and
Okay, fine. I won't bring up Lua. Prime, you ask your next question. I'll cede the floor.
Thank you. You should have. We should never even have done that. Okay, so speaking of, like, the hater, especially with, like, the whole generics thing and people piling onto you, how do you manage open source and the haters, the detractors. Oh, great. We have another term. I'm sure you've already heard that. Another terminal emulator. There's always like all the different kind of reasons why someone's going to come on and just start saying weird things, or they're just going to open up issues that are nonsense, kind of just as insults or whatever. How do you kind of manage all of that from an open source software perspective?
So there's a serious answer, which is that I read the negative feedback because I think that the negative feedback is usually like 90% emotion, but 10% truth. And I try to find the truth that's in there, and I want to hear it. Like I've never once blocked someone on Twitter to this day or any social media platform. I don't think blocking is a good thing because it's sort of like I want to understand like where they're coming from. And so, yeah, that's something I've always done. But that's sort of the serious answer. I mean, I think the unserious answer or less serious is that I've been doing open source in some capacity for like almost 15 years now, in a paid capacity, I guess I should say, or just like full time capacity. And I just sort of learned to brush it off. I mean, that's really all you got to do. It's sort of a learned practice to realize that, you know, everyone can't be pleased. Some people are angry for the sake of being angry, and there's no saving that situation. And you just kind of brush it off. I mean, like, what was happening yesterday, for example? I don't read Reddit, for what it's worth. Or
good plan.
Minutes, I should
good,
say.
Good answer. Good answer.
But yesterday I had some friends that were like, hey, do you have time to hop on a video call? I want to act out some Reddit comments. And I'm like, okay, that sounds pretty funny. And so like, this is something we've done before. This isn't a first time thing. And so this is when we do other things. And so they pulled up some angry Reddit comments from a variety of subreddits, and they try to act out that person saying that comment.
This is an incredible YouTube video, by the way. This is so good. And if Reddit comments were real. Time. Yeah.
Call us. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to act it out, but yeah, I mean, if you take a Reddit comment that's angry and then you act it out in an overly dramatic voice, it ends up being extremely comedic. And so that's a mechanism, I guess a technique we use to hear about negative comments is doing that. Because if you take some of these comments and read them out loud, especially if you're outside, sit in a park and read these comments out loud, they sound so unhinged of like, oh, how is this so important to anybody? That's sort of the technique, basically.
My goodness, please, the next time, please, you got to link us those comments. We would immediately take this into a video. That is such a funny idea. Because I've done it with GitHub issues, but I've never done it with Reddit comments, which seem even better, especially outside touching grass and being super offended.
Yeah, exactly. I'm already seeing a hilarious video, Prime, where we go do this together in a park, but we're like yelling. So like regular, but not like in SF, you know what I mean? Like in South Dakota, right? Yeah. Like where nobody knows any of the Git words we're using, and they're like screaming about, there's no static dispatch in this language. How could you, you know? And then
exactly.
Just passerby.
It's completely useless. It's like, it's crazy.
That's pretty good.
Okay, we're doing this. I'm putting it on our, it on our to-do list.
Very good.
But sort of speaking of the like open source aspects of the project, one of the things that I think is really interesting about Ghosty, right, is that it is at least like for now, and as far as you've said, like just a like a passion project for you. Like, how do you see, I don't know, like the future sustainability, like of the project as a whole? How are you envisioning its future? I don't, like, it's hard to guess what software is going to look like in 5 years, but just like going forward as a passion project.
Yeah, I think that's the most unknown that I, you know, metaphorically keeps me up at night. I'm in a position where I could support myself working on this project, and so that doesn't stress me out at all. But there's a number of fantastic contributors, community members that have popped up. You know, I don't think I'm going to be working on Terminal my entire life. And so I want to set this up in a way that others could sort of eventually take it over or get more involved and things like that. But, you know, how do they sort of remain sustainable and things like that? And so that's with the 1.0 and unanswered question, there's a discussion that is public now. You could read, we've had open for like a year through the private beta on how we could sort of do that. And I just, quite frankly, don't know yet, but it's something I want to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one thing we're pursuing is I am looking at sort of a foundation based model for not putting in another foundation, but, you know, starting our own foundation around the Ghosty project, because if we do that, I am willing to like donate to it, but I think we need to come up with a way that, you know, others find more interest. And I think LibGhosty can help a lot with this, because I think that if LibGhosty becomes the core for something that's very important, such as VS Code, for example, then there's something that, or GitHub code spaces, I guess, which is VS Code to some extent. But, you know, if you get companies to hinge on this stuff, then you could more easily find sort of corporate sponsorship that can maybe make this work long-term. You know, some projects like FFmpeg struggle still because they're so low in the stack. But yeah, I am willing to sort of lean on relationships that I've had at those companies from working at, you know, HashiCorp in order to try to find support for this over time. But we're just not at a place where I could do that yet.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. I think one of the interesting things you've written about the project as well along these lines is you've called it, in a sense, sort of like technical philanthropy. I don't know if you have anything you want to say about that. I just thought it was cool when I was reading that from some of your stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I reached this sort of point in my career where I didn't want to sort of work for money anymore, but I knew I loved to work, but I didn't want that to be wasted time either. And so, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, you should do some more social good and things like that. And so, you know, part of it is my family is involved in sort of charitable things. We do technical, like financial philanthropy. Like we've donated to Zig, we've donated to Lady Bird, and there's some other things that that we haven't sort of publicized that we've been part of. And then there's sort of part of it where it's like, but I'm always going to code. I love coding. And so is there a way to make my time coding helpful to people in some way? And so I sort of view this terminal as like, I can make it free. It's something that most developers use every single day. A terminal is, and if I sort of build something that I think is good and give it away, then maybe it's sort of another form of philanthropy. And that's that's one way I look at it.
Yeah, how do you manage this like passion for new projects and then this point? Because I assume trying to figure out a foundation, trying to figure out how to get it so that it's a sustainable project, all that. At some point, you have to do less and less coding, and you're doing more and more trying to figure out these soft parts of the project. How do you continue to stay motivated and not just go, I am kind of finished with this side. I don't want to be a part of it anymore.
Just like time boxing, I guess, and realizing, you know, there's no pressure to do this. It's all really like optional at the end of the day. I mean, I think that's the thing that, you know, if I want to instead code something, then I could just tell myself, you know, I could wait. This could wait a day. I could go code. And also, you know, the fallback in the worst case is not bad. Like it's an MIT-based project. Like in the worst case scenario, I could just say, hey, I'm burnt out. I don't want to do this anymore. It's open source. I did my best. Please, you know, whatever happens, happens. And I don't think that's like a bad outcome for people either. So that always like sort of gives me peace at the end of the day that there's that. But there's also another component where I do genuinely like to work, and work isn't always fun, and work can't always be fun. So I sort of am like totally fine having the parts of work that I realize I don't love to do. It's just that as long as that doesn't take over my full life, then it's okay with me.
Yeah, can you tell Prime that's true about checking his email and calendar too? That would be super helpful if I could get a personalized message from you to Prime about that.
Honestly, you guys kept cutting out. What were you saying? I just couldn't really understand you guys.
We'll send you an email.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so I guess just kind of drilling in on this more, and this is maybe a bit of a philosophical question. Do you think that your situation is unique? Meaning, do you think that anybody at any point, if given financial freedom, would choose to build something like this? Or is this kind of a unique thing about you that is unique to work itself? Because even wanting to work for others is kind of a weird position to be in.
Hmm.
Because this is kind of like the Star Trek future. I'm kind of hinting at, like, is the Star Trek future possible? Are you normal or are you an anomaly?
I think, I don't know, maybe it's just the people that I'm around or something. I think there's plenty of people that will continue to, would do, if they were in the same position as me, would continue doing something like this. Maybe not a terminal, though. That's the most unhinged part of the whole thing. But
fair.
But something, you know, like, I think the best data points I have for that are I'm very close friends with a lot of the early employees that were at HashiCorp that are no longer there, and they did well financially to the point where they probably don't have to work anymore. And as far as I know, when I'm just running it through my head, most of them have gone back to work. And I just think that there's a part of, like, purpose and then unlocking working for, like, companies or causes that you really want to. That's the freeing part, I think. There's not a lot of, like, I don't know. I think I have faith that people would do that. But then I think that my position in general is fairly unique. So, yeah, I would say that.
Yeah, speaking of people never working anymore and AI taking over every job, which is not our position, by the way. But I am interested sort of just like with a lot of the different stuff going on with AI. You know, as I was stalking your Nix.js files, you know, I noticed Copilot and a few other like AI tools. Like, I'm interested sort of in like, writing a terminal emulator in Zig is kind of like uncharted territories for AI. So I'm wondering, like, are you using Copilot there or other things? Are you like, were they helpful in this sort of like new area that people haven't done before in a newer language, and sort of your experience along that axis?
Yeah. I use Copilot. It was, and I use other AI based tooling as well, but, I find it invaluable. Like, and with Zig, it was super, it worked really well. And I actually saw like, however it works, I saw Copilot get better and better over the past 2 years at Zig completions. I think it's very different when I work on something that is like JavaScript versus Zig. You know, with Zig, I feel like LLMs and so on are sort of just like nice autocomplete, like line level or pattern autocomplete. Like if I'm doing an enum and it's following the same pattern, like it's really, really good at that. But it's not good at like write a comment being like, you know, find the next largest prime number, you know, and then it's not good at figuring the code for that. But when I'm writing JavaScript, it's literally like, you know, answer this whole question and it writes me 200 lines and it's like pretty close to being correct. Mm-hmm. With Zig, you can't get that. I'm really optimistic and I think they're really important tools that every programmer should be using. I find it increasingly suspicious when a programmer of any sort of caliber talks shit about the utility of them. You know, you could question the copyright issue, you could question the power usage, you could question sort of the ethics of the whole thing, but to question the actual utility of what they're providing, I find extremely suspicious. I've always viewed it, someone else has said this, but I agree wholeheartedly. It's like being given a dozen sort of new grad level programmers that have never worked before, and you don't have to pay them and or feed them, and they just work constantly. And like, that's sort of the feeling that I've gotten from it. It's sort of like, if they've ever become sentient and want rights, then I'm totally screwed because I drive my AI into the ground. But you know, that's the benefit.
Do you think that there's ever, well, first off, actually, let's go to the copyright one. Do you think that there is a problem brewing for these AIs under some of this? I'm not an expert at copyright law. Or even a novice, shall we say. Bird law, yes. Copyright, no.
I want there to be legal precedent to tell me what the answer is. That's my biggest issue right now. So this actually came up 2 days ago. So Ghosty is an MIT licensed project. a lot, most of the other major terminals are GPL based. Kitty is GPL, iTerm is GPL, all the GNOME terminals are GPL. Someone posted a discussion being like, here's how iTerm does something, and I immediately had to delete it and like not look at the code. And I was like, oh, you can't share iTerm code because it's GPL based. And then the next response was like, okay, I asked an LLM and here's what ChatGPT told me. And I don't know, I didn't see what iTerm wrote. I didn't look at the iTerm code, so I don't know how similar it is or whatever. But I'm like, where did it get trained on this? And is this at, like, does the GPL go through the training process? And I don't have the answer. I'm not an expert. I really want there to be like an Oracle v Google type case for this so that we could just have an answer, because that for whatever side you fell on that case, it just gave you a lot of answers of how to behave in various licensing things. And we need that for LLMs.
Yeah, I do think there is like going to be, I don't know when they'll decide the case or anything, but there are going to be a lot of sort of, how could you say, recycling of licensed code into unlicensed code through LLMs coming up soon. Even if you just like, where is the attribution? I could just like go open up iTerm code or something and then say summarize this, and then what can anyone do afterwards? You know, it seems quite difficult to figure those things out and even get proper attribution backwards towards the original code there.
Yeah. And then like, you know, I'm not an expert either. So maybe it is a trivial problem. I don't think it is, but I don't know. But I just don't know. I just need someone who is an expert with some sort of authority to tell me what I'm supposed to do. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Are you worried about your usage of Copilot? Because, you know, if Copilot somehow has some pretty good ideas about how a terminal should behave in a specific case, are you worried that it's just like, I saw this on Kitty, Zigify, and then all of a sudden you're just like, oh no.
I'm not, because it's not writing code that well. Since it's doing autocomplete for me, the AI is stupid. It's sort of like, I mean, that's something that like the Oracle v Google case kind of covered, which is sort of like trivial code can't be copyrighted or licensed or whatever the term is, even if it's identical, right? Like something like that. And so like when I type half a thing and it completes the rest of the thing, I'm not too worried about. If I happen to type the same thing that Kitty does, I don't know, but
let's pretend that it's, you know, Google v Oracle case comes down for LLMs and a bunch of stuff gets dished out and there's a bunch of like analysis comes out and you are handed a new license because this happens, or you have to somehow pull out the code and rewrite a bunch of stuff. What would you do in that situation?
I'd probably rewrite stuff. I just don't think that, in my case, I don't think enough was AI generated that it would actually be impactful to what I did. And so I would probably just rewrite it. I mean, that was my approach with like, when we relicensed from closed source proprietary to MIT for Ghosty, I wrote a script that like pulled out all the Git blames of all the lines that were not written by me, and then cross-checked it with a CSV file of people that didn't email me back with their approvals. And I was like, I could just rewrite this. This is not a big deal.
Nice. Well, we're just about at that time to transition into our live Q&A. So if you're a chatter and you can enter into the Discord right now, you should do that to start getting questions ready. We do have a pretty funny first
it's from
Q&A
Pick.
Question.
It's from Pick.
Oh, it's from Pick. Even better.
Yeah.
Pick, shout out Pick, Haskell nerd, one of seven that exists on the internet, not focused only on writing white papers, gainfully employed. Incredible. It's a one of a kind story. So not sure if this has been asked. Which one is harder, writing Rust or flying a jet?
That's never been asked before. I'm trying to think if they're even comparable. It doesn't even make sense. Like, you're a Haskell person, you should understand that you know, one's an ordinal and one isn't. You can't compare these things.
Based and owned. So good.
Take that.
I don't know. I don't know. They're just so different. I'm so sorry. I can't answer that question.
Okay. I'll ask a different one.
Hold on. I'm gonna do one personal question. I did want to finish up with the AI side. One. Do you think that of the current suite of tools out there, that there is one that is actually really good for developers to take advantage of all the time? Or do you feel like there needs to be a new tool that kind of changes how the integration between, say, these LLMs, these simulated reasoners, and your editor? Is there like a better version that does not exist today?
Well, I mean, in the year 2024 going on 2025, I think there's zero excuse to not be using some kind of autocomplete based LLM, whether it's, you know, Copilot or whatever it is, but there's no excuse. It's strictly upside to me. There's zero downside. Just send it. Even if it provides value one out of 50 times, you could just ignore the other 49 shadows. Like that to me, I think that the cursor style interactions and sort of bigger sort of integrations, I think they need to bake a little bit more. I think they're excellent for things like Python and JavaScript. And I think that they're questionable for other things. And so, you know, I just think that needs a bit more time.
Okay, I do have to do one follow-up one, which is the Copilot pause. Have you ever turned off Copilot and seen how you interact with your editor without it on?
Yeah. I mean, Copilot's down sometimes. And then also, if I'm in a scenario where the internet is bad, I don't know, I feel like people might hate me for this, but like it's reached the point where it was like when your email was down at work, like 15 years ago, when Gmail used to sometimes go down, where like when the email went down, you're just like, I guess I get the day off. Like that was it. And it sort of reached that point where when like I type something and I'll wait and it's been like 10 seconds and nothing showed up. I sort of like, you know,
I'm done for the day.
Yeah. I'm like, well, I guess I'm done now. And so maybe that makes me like a really like terrible programmer now, but I've just sort of been like, why am I going to work so hard? Like, yeah, I need my intern army back.
Right now, there's 1,000 people with the Kobe Bryant image of him going soft, just right now playing in their head.
Oh man, that reference is such an unintentional like hits in so many different ways. I'm from LA. I'm a big Lakers fan. Kobe died in an aviation accident while I was sitting on the airport in flight training when I saw his helicopter take off the day he died.
Whoa.
And so like your reference just now just like crossed a ton of things. It's wild.
He's deleting Copilot after that. He's like, it's fine.
Yeah.
Take back everything I said. I changed my mind. AI's evil and I can't use it.
Yep.
All right, while we're waiting for a few user submitted questions, I had a sort of live ghosty related question. I'm kind of interested in as like a concept of one thing that's kind of like annoying about terminals is like stuff's monospaced. You can't like have different zoom and font sizes or like images as easily. These days I know like Kitty and stuff, we're getting there, maybe Kitty protocol. But one thing that I thought would be cool is like, I'd like to have NeoVim still in the TUI, right? You know, sort of just like normal. But I'd like to have a split like inside the same window, right? So like I have an OS window, I have my actual TUI here, and I like do a NeoVim command or something and I split, and like part of the window is like, we'll say a browser, right? It could render HTML, it could be something else too. Do you think libghosty enables that kind of like future? Could someone make that as like an application, and then I could control the split from NeoVim? This is just my. Sorry, I have to ask my.
Actually just doing a feature request, by the way.
This is a GitHub discussion. Yeah. Consider this a GitHub discussion.
We're discussing.
I think to make that possible, you would have to have like a libghosty tmux style implementation. But I think that this is one of those scenarios that Prime was just talking about. You just propose the solution, and I think what you actually want is different from what you propose. And so I think in this case, what I actually want to do is what terminal emulators aren't capable of today, which is being able to send escape sequences to create. So terminals have this concept of primary and alternate screen. There's actually two terminals active for every terminal. You're either like the one you're typing in your shell is your primary. And when you open NeoVim, you know how it takes over the whole screen. That's your alternate screen. And when you exit, you go straight back to your shell. Like NeoVim didn't remember your shell. The terminal maintains these two screens. I want to propose that we introduce N screens, not just primary and alternate, be able to introduce more screens than two, and then be able to assign those screens to native widgets. And so you could say screen 3 is actually a NeoVim tab, a NeoBIM editor, I guess it wouldn't care at that point. And the user could control, I want screen three in a tab, I want screen three in a split. And to NeoBIM, it would just look like another terminal sending resize events or whatever. It should just be able to render like a normal, like single instance NeoBIM thing. And that's sort of like my vision of that future. And that sort of comes from people like you, but the number one thing I ask people is people that don't use NeoBIM in the terminal, they use a dedicated app like NeoVide or something. I just ask why. NeoVide's excellent, by the way, but I just want to know why, what's the gap between a native application and using it, a GUI application, using it in the TUI. And I think that that gap is exactly the highest priority things that VTC, control sequence improvements should be focused on. The practical gap, I should say. Yeah.
Nice. Cool. Thanks. That is helpful. Yeah. I'm open to any solution. I just want to be able to have a different like variable sized like thing where I can zoom in and out independently, but it's like part of the same given. Yeah. Anyways, okay. We've got some questions. We'll open up with one that's a little broad, but I do like it. What were the biggest hardships while building Ghosty and how did you overcome them?
I don't know. This is probably not the answer you're going to be looking for, but the hardest thing to me when building Ghosty was balancing my desire to be with my newborn daughter all the time and my passion for coding. And I don't mean the practical, like finding time to code, because that's a real thing. I mean, like actually, like when I had unarguably free time to code, like she's napping or something, just like me missing her so much and wanting to be with her, you know, like it was so distracting to me. And so I think, like, you know, I don't know if hardship's the right word, but I think the most difficult non-technical like feeling I had to deal with throughout building Ghosty was balancing out, like, I just have so much fun being with my kid, like doing that versus, but when I was with her, I would want to be coding sometimes, right? Like I missed it. Mm-hmm. And so it would really go back and forth. I felt guilty on both sides, and trying to figure out how to manage that was something pre-parent I never conceptualized in my mind as a possibility. So that was interesting.
It is such a relatable answer and such a good answer, which is that I have found my life is more based on constraints than ever. I'm up to four kids at this point, so I have quite a few of them, and it's just like the whole...
Stop now?
Because I got a snip. That's why I stopped. Yeah, I've been capable. I showed up a week early and accidentally took Vicodin, so there's a whole story to that. But nonetheless, okay. I just find like every decision I now make passes through a filter, and I know that I have 55 hours a week. That is what I have to code or plan or write YouTube scripts or investigate something. That's like, that is my time, because if I exceed any amount of it, I know that that means at 4 p.m. I can't get off when my kids are effectively back from school. I know that means in the evening I have to say no to my wife to just hang out with her in some sort of capacity, or I don't read to my kids, or I don't, like, every decision now goes through this weird like filtration system of like, man, I really want to do this. I feel guilty for not working on this thing, but man, if I don't, then I don't do this. And it's just like, it just gets harder and harder and harder, and it's not getting easier, it seems like.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. Wait till your kid's like 10 or 11 and they can just like reason with you and talk about cool stuff. Oh my gosh. Like yesterday.
It's better though.
It is way better. It's way better.
Harder and better.
But it's like, like you have to self-sacrifice the things you want to do for somebody else. And especially when it comes to things that are like probably hitting both purpose and addiction, which is coding, it becomes, I feel like, exceptionally hard to say no to. Like yesterday, I was supposed to work just on Laravel stuff. I was going to take an extra day and just really understand some things with Laravel, but my kids are playing Fortnite. And so instead, I for like 80% of the day, I just played Fortnite with my kids and just crushed it out because it was like so fun. But it's just like, but at the same time, I'm feeling progressively more guilty for not doing the other stuff. Man, that is the most relatable thing 2020 has ever offered me.
Well, that's mostly a Fortnite problem, Prime. You should try something more rewarding with them.
Dude, it's so fun playing Fortnite with the kids.
Get them on POE2 with you, hardcore.
Oh man, I had COVID. We were supposed to record this for everyone. I guess we were supposed to record this like a couple weeks ago, and I got COVID and like was like not well. But when I in the moments that I was well, I just like crushed through the POE2 campaign. I got to hardcore, but then I got better, and so I couldn't play anymore. So
Yeah. I'm only in the 20s in hardcore. I really want to get up into the big one.
Yep.
All right, TJ, do you have another question?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things you talked about for like making Ghosty was this idea, like you just picked some technologies because you wanted to learn them. And so we have a question, sort of what's your approach to learning? Do you have a systematic approach? Do you have like any sort of particular insights into learning?
I do. I have my own approach, and it's also something I think people will hate because it's probably like I'm very old for doing this, but I have this approach where I, step one, read the entire reference manual for whatever I'm about to learn.
I knew TJ would be excited.
So I will find, like, Zig found the language reference. It's like the scroll bar is like tiny, and I just read the whole thing. That's step one. If it's a programming language, the next thing I do is I go through and I start reading the entire standard library end to end. And then after that, I build something. So
how did you do that with Go? Because Go Standard Library is huge.
Yeah, I gave a talk at a GopherCon like 2014 about sort of testing patterns for Go. And like the key takeaway, I was like, so I didn't invent any of these. These are all in the standard library, but no one else is doing them because I don't think anyone else read the standard library. So here you go. You just read it. You just read it. I mean, it was smaller. It was smaller when I started using Go, but
Could help.
You know, the asterisk there is like, I wouldn't do this with C++, but you know,
that's because you cannot read it.
Yeah. So generally, exactly. Generally speaking, this is my pattern, but there are exceptions.
If you do jump to definition on some standard library item of C++, it's like getting hit with light theme at 2 a.m. Like you just look at it, you're like, what am I seeing? I don't even understand this.
Yes. It makes me want to write Rust.
So that you can hit those too. But a quick question then on the follow-up, do you actually just read every line of code? Like, did you look through the HTTP implementation or the WebSocket implementation or whatever, you know, quote unquote, or when you say read the standard library, are you reading all the docs to every single method or do you read the methods themselves?
No, I'm reading the code, but I'm not like getting a full understanding of the code, but I'm like reading through it and making sure I understand sort of like the general picture of what they're trying to do, basically. I think Python is actually the example for this. Python has like, it's kind of interesting because the Python standard library goes from like, I don't know, like early 2000 style Python to like very modern Python. It's still shipped in the standard library. And so I don't know, sometimes like, and Python is a very feature rich language. So sometimes I'll just be reading the standard library and being like, what is that syntax? Like, what is that? And you know, I may have read about it in the reference or something, but, you know, this sort of stuff the reason you build at the end of this is because reading references doesn't make you an expert. It just makes you like better at recognizing things. And so, it's more just like a recognition game. And then I build to actually cause it to stick into me.
All right. This is kind of a weird one, and this has changed throughout my life, especially with kids, which is being productive morning or evening.
Yeah, that changed a lot with kids. I mean, now it's actually just like daytime, I guess, is how I would describe it, because I want to be with my kid during the morning before she goes and does whatever she's going to do. And I want to be with my kid in the afternoon when she gets back from whatever she's done. And so it's really just like daytime. There's a lot more nights for sure than before. But yeah, I think and with kids too, I go to bed earlier, right? So like I'm like head on pillow asleep at like 10 p.m. and I'm waking up at like 5:45, 6 a.m. And so, and I feel great because that's like 8 hours. And before, I would say like 18 months ago, my kid's 16 months old right now. 18 months ago, I think my sleeping pattern was probably like 12:30, 1 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. or something, you know? And that changed a lot of things for me.
All right.
What are some other things? I wanted to ask the follow-up question. What other things, you know, has parenthood, affected you or changed about you?
I mean, there's probably so many, but I can't. When they come up, I'll mention them. But I mean, I think I mentioned the two already, and those are pretty big.
Yeah.
All right. So when it comes to kind of implementing things yourself versus using a pre-existing library, Joel on Code had a really interesting article, which is that you should implement pretty much everything yourself that is core to the business, and then you can bring in the things that aren't core to the business. How do you kind of do that with Ghosty or any of your projects, really? When do you choose to re-implement, say, HTTP? You're not going to re-implement it, but let's just pretend you do, versus just using an off-the-shelf library.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm a big fan. I've tweeted this before, but I'm a big fan of you should probably be building almost everything yourself. And the reason for that is because the amount of functionality you need of the thing that you're pulling in as a library is usually very small. So like you don't want to implement CLI argument parsing. So you bring in this thing that does all this stuff for you, but really all you want to do is like parse a single flag, you know, like if you're doing that, it's such a waste. And you know, people argue, oh, there's security risks. You don't get updates, things like that. And I don't know. In my experience, there's been far more security problems introduced by updating a library with new features that I don't use than by never upgrading ever again. And so I'm sort of this big fan of build everything yourself. It's very polarizing. This came up as like a very contentious topic while I was in management at HashiCorp, because we invented a lot of stuff by ourselves, CLI parsing, a lot of networking stuff. We did that for necessity because when we started, Go was not mature and literally there were no options. But as time went on, I remember it was very common at one point for new employees to be like, we should replace our homegrown CLI library with this other one because it has a dozen more features. And the dozen more features isn't wrong, but at the same time, it's like, do we need them? Like, we don't, what's the point? This is just like spinning our wheels for no reason. And it always led to sort of like an argument, basically. But I'm pretty strong on the side of just invent everything yourself.
What's like the biggest downside that you had from inventing it yourself? What's the one you regretted, if there is one?
Yeah. I mean, it's really fun when you can make your problems someone else's problems. That's the best part about using somebody else's library is you could just be like, yep, I have a bug. Here you go. You solve it. I mean, you kind of have to figure it out on your own at some point because you have to like obviously get past that in your program as well. But the ability to like punt the right solution to somebody else and you just have to worry about a Band-Aid is really nice versus when you own the library, you have to, or, you know, own the functionality, you really have to probably figure out the right solution yourself. And that's the hardest part.
I want to keep on asking more questions about this, TJ, so you have to hold on. There's a very common argument that you're going to get, which is that if I use React or I use whatever, something off the shelf, I use any of these things off the shelf, by using that, every new person that comes in, they'll be more immediately useful. Is that a good argument? Do you think that argument makes sense in any sort of duration? Or is that kind of one of those arguments that we tell ourselves to avoid writing new things?
Oh no, I think that's very real. I would split some hairs somewhere between a framework and like a library somewhere. You know, at the end of the day, they're all some kind of library. But like a huge architectural choice, like a framework, I would definitely pick something off the shelf. I wouldn't be writing that from scratch, and that's exactly for the reason you just said, which is that it's sort of like everything else is good enough, and you're going to get so much more productivity for hiring on that. Then that's worth it. Yeah. So it's like that we did that with the Ghosty website, for example. The Ghosty website is just Next.js React. And, you know, Zig has a really cool like static site generator called Zine, which I think is actually really great. But a lot of Zig people ask why wouldn't we use Zine for like a Zig project? But my argument was like, we're a terminal and the website is just incidental to the terminal. And I'm seeing way more benefit right now. We're getting so many pull requests on the website repo because everybody in the world knows React. So, yeah.
Am I allowed to ask a question now, Prime, or you're...
I still have a bajillion on this line, but I'll let it go.
Do another one.
No, you go, baby.
Okay, all right, nice. So while you were working on Ghosty, was there anything you really missed from being like CEO, CTO back at HashiCorp?
I'm not sure if they're asking if something I missed about the role or something I missed about like the actual that specific company.
Either one.
I could answer. Yeah. So I mean, I think that I missed, I'll talk more generally. I mean, I think I miss working with people. It's really fun to go into an office or a virtual office, whether you're remote, and just like have a bunch of people that are aligned behind the same goals as you and just be able to talk to them. I still continue to miss that to this day. But the other thing I missed, which is a little funnier, I guess, is shared responsibility. Is sort of like with Ghosty, there's more contributors now, but when someone reports a bug, I'm like, I'm the only person who's going to do this. Like, and that pressure kind of sucks. It's really nice when you're on a team being like, you know, like, I'm not feeling it right now. Can you take this one on? And there's someone there. You know, the open source community will mature and things will get better, but it's not the same as someone who, you know, you're both paid to do this, right? And so I think those are the two things that that I miss. One is sort of social and one is sort of practical, technical. Yeah.
Great. Thanks.
All right. So what is your strategy for tackling large scope, and how do you break it down into smaller desirable work pieces? And how, if, and can AI help with this? And how do you kind of distribute it, especially with open source? Are there big things where you can actually distribute the work, or is it really still just all on you?
The easy one is AI could definitely not help with this, because AI is a CS new grad that has never worked before. So they are very dumb.
PhD intelligence though. So careful now.
Okay.
They don't have management. I don't know if you know that. That's a college degree.
I'm able to get my rage out on AIs because they don't exist. So I just yell.
Based answer.
If Siri or Alexa ever realizes how inhumane I treat them, then I am so toast. It's unbelievable. But
No. The answer is the future AIs, if they ever achieve intelligence, will respect the people who did not treat these inferior, like, you know, computing programs like a proper intelligence, right? So you and I will be safe, right? Because we've been mistreating these bad ones.
If you look at my ChatGPT history, it's like a deep R-rated movie. It's like ask question, and then the next one is like, God damn it, you stupid. Yeah, it's like just go off. And then it's just like the next one is like, I'm so sorry, you're right, here's the better answer. And I'm like, no, this is, you know, it's anyway, wait. The original question, big scope, little scope. Okay, so I actually blogged about this a little bit, about managing complexity, but I try to break things down. You know, I try to break things down into smaller scoped projects. I always like to make issues sort of the size of a couple days of work at most, because I think that that's the most contributor friendly. And that's how I could delegate the best in an open source project. And that's my goal. They're not all like that, but I think as a maintainer, but this is not just open source. In the corporate world, I felt like as sort of the owner of a product, it was your responsibility to maintain the large scope vision in your head and to break that down for other people so that they don't have to maintain that in their head. So, yeah.
Awesome. I think we've got one more question, and then we're just at about time, unless, Prime, you have any other ones you want to ask?
No.
Okay. Are hash browns the ultimate breakfast food, or do you prefer sweet breakfast instead?
Oh, no. Oh, okay. Yes. So hash browns and an Egg McMuffin together, specifically from McDonald's.
Oh, yeah. Sausage Egg McMuffin or just Egg McMuffin?
Just plain Egg McMuffin. I think like that is the closest thing to a perfect food. Like if Michelin could invent a 4-star, I think they should just reserve it for only McDonald's, whatever number that is. It varies by country. I don't know if they still have it. In the Amsterdam airport, there's a McDonald's in there. And they have something called the New York, which is really appropriate. And you would get 2 Egg McMuffins and 2 hash browns, and that was it. And I'd never been to another McDonald's that had this option. And I thought that was the perfect meal.
Right, I think there. McDonald's so, does yeah. this kind of variation, because when I was up in Anchorage, Alaska, right outside of Denali, there was the Denali Mac, which was 3-layer Big Mac as opposed to a 2-layer Big Mac. Oh, yeah, the Denali Mac was a real deal.
So yeah, I don't eat at McDonald's very often, and but I don't eat anything else at McDonald's. The only thing I have is an Egg McMuffin and hash brown. That's it. And that's my preferred breakfast.
All right. Well, just to make all the haters happy, pineapple and pizza, yes or no?
I haven't in a long time, I guess. But I'm not like against. I think it's good. I think it tastes good. It's not my preferred pizza though, but I think it tastes good.
There you go. Well, thanks, Mitchell. Thanks for coming to this episode of Top Shelf. Everybody, Ghosty is out now, public, so you can try it. It's available everywhere unless you use Windows, so I don't know what to tell you. It's coming soon on Windows. I don't know what the plan is.
You could build it for WSL on Windows, but okay, that's nice. That's not the intended. Yeah, I want to build a native application for Windows eventually.
Nice. Do you have any links or anything you want to shout out specifically that we can link in the YouTube video or anything like that?
I think ghosty.org, and we're good with that. I think you could find everything from there.
Sweet. Well, thanks, Mitchell. We appreciate your time, and hopefully everyone enjoyed this episode of Top Shelf. Goodbye, everyone.
Yeah, we're gonna cut the stream, and then you can stick around for a second. Bye. I didn't wave. Can I also wave? I'll wave you like can, Harry Potter.
Bye.
There we go.
Harry Potter wave. Let's go.